Some of the views expressed on the Mormon Channel are solely for the education and inspiration of our audience and may not represent the official position of the Church.
We welcome you again to Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Our program looks at issues, people, places, events associated with the history of the Church. I'm Brent Topp, Chair of the Department of Church History and Doctrine at BYU, your host. And with me today, I am really pleased and honored to have as our guest Dr. Bruce Van Orden, Emeritus Professor of Church History and Doctrine at BYU and a good friend for many, many years. Bruce, we are so glad to have you on our program.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
Today, we are going to talk about missionary work generally, but specifically the mission of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles to Great Britain. And I find it interesting, Bruce, as we talk about this, that it starts in one period of church history, but it really permeates and influences all of the periods of history of the church. And maybe we can start by having you share with us and teach us about the role of the Quorum of the Twelve in missionary work worldwide and how that's going to lead into the work of the 12 in Great Britain.
Prior to 1835, the church was led by the Prophet Joseph Smith, of course, with the assistance of able counselors like Sidney Rigdon, Frederick G. Williams, Oliver Cowdery in Missouri, which was a long way away from Ohio. But it had always been part of the plan based on Section 20 of the Doctrine and Covenants and Section 18 of the Doctrine and Covenants, that there would be apostles. And after Zion's Camp took place, which was a preparatory period for many leaders, Section 107 was received, in which the Quorum of the Twelve and the 70 were called in addition to a first presidency. And we read in Section 107, verse 33, that the 12 are a traveling, presiding high council to officiate in the name of the Lord under the direction of the presidency of the church, to build up the church and regulate all the affairs of the same in all nations. And then it goes on to say about the 70 having the same exact mission but under the direction of the 12. And they would take the gospel as a missionary endeavor to all the nations of the earth, as it prophesies, and we're in the process of seeing that occur as the years go by in the restoration of the gospel in the dispensation of the fullness of times, and it's accelerating. But it had to begin somewhere, and in the late 1830s, following this 1835 revelation, it got rolling.
So what were the first attempts of the 12 to send the missionaries to fulfill that charge to go into all the world? And so we know that there was missionary work in the eastern states and the western frontier and all of those things. Was there a move to have missionaries in the 12 outside of the United States?
Yes, definitely. When we consider what is now the nation of Canada, Upper Canada, as it was known, is Southern Ontario. And it was called Upper Canada because it's the upper regions of the St. Lawrence River. Lower Canada would be the Quebec area, French-speaking Canada, even to the present day. There were no guards at the international border between New York and Vermont heading into Upper Canada, and it was English-speaking, and many of the people who lived in Upper Canada were actually former citizens of the United States. So it was not considered foreign, but in effect it was, and it laid the groundwork for preaching the gospel in Great Britain. In 1836, Elder Heber C. Kimball of the 12 was asked to give a blessing to Elder Parley P. Pratt, also of the 12, as he would embark on a mission to Toronto in Upper Canada. And in this blessing, he promised that they would have tremendous success and that the labors would lead to extending the gospel to England. And indeed, that happened. There were several people baptized, converted and baptized, who were former residents of England, having just emigrated to Canada in the recent months and years. Included in these were John Taylor, later to be president of the church, and Joseph Fielding and his family, who have had a tremendous impact upon the history of the church, and they both were Englanders. So that kind of set the stage for what became the first apostolic mission to Britain.
Wow. Well, let's talk about that. So Canada is kind of the jumping off point, if you will, because of their family relations back in the British Isles. Why don't we talk a little bit about how the call of the 12 to Great Britain came about, and what was the setting or the context for those first missionaries being called to go across the ocean to the British Isles?
Well, context is everything, as you are hinting. The setting must always be understood. For all the revelations that have come forth in this last dispensation, setting is always important. And the setting in 1837, when this took place, was not a good one. The church had fallen into tremendous apostasy. We even call it the Great Apostasy of 1837, when about a third of the members of the church fell away. And the spirit of apostasy even fell into members of the 12, either permanently or temporarily. It was a dire situation. The church was going through bankruptcy proceedings also. And during this crisis, the Lord revealed to Joseph Smith that, quote, something new must be done for the salvation of my church. So on Sunday, the 4th of June, 1837, in the temple, Kirtland Temple, Joseph Smith confided to Heber C. Kimball, of the 12, quote, Brother Heber, the Spirit of the Lord has whispered to me, let my servant Heber go to England and proclaim my gospel and open the door of salvation to that nation. And as a result of the success of that mission and the mission of the entire Quorum of the 12 that followed, all the ill effects of the apostasy, the being driven from Ohio and then the extermination order out of Missouri and the various other forms of chaos and troubles that the saints were going through, all of these were counteracted by the importance of the taking the gospel to the British Isles.
Great. That's very fascinating. Bruce, as we talked about the revelation or the spiritual prompting that the prophet Joseph had to call Heber C. Kimball to the British Isles, let's build on that and say and talk about what does Heber then do, and who else is involved in this first effort to go across the ocean to take the gospel to the British Isles.
Elder Kimball, along with all the other members of the 12, were in their late 20s or early 30s. He was actually in his early 30s. He felt overwhelmed about this calling because he knew that the best educated nation in the world was Great Britain, and he had limited education and a lack of refinement. And he recorded, the idea of being appointed to such an important office and mission was almost more than I could bear up under. I felt my weakness and unworthiness. But he called upon God for strength, as he had always done. He was a very trusting man in God's power. He selected companions to go with him. His first choice was Willard Richards, who had only been a member of the church for 6 months and had already served a mission in the Eastern States. And this turned out to be great because we all know that Willard Richards contributed so much to the church in the 12 and in the First Presidency. He selected Joseph Fielding, a native of England and who had come to Kirtland after having been converted in the Parley P. Pratt mission. Elder Orson Hyde stepped into the room when Joseph Smith was setting apart Elder Kimball on the 11th of June. And Elder Hyde, who had succumbed to the spirit of apostasy rampant in Kirtland, had come, I guess, to discuss this with Joseph Smith. But beholding this setting apart and feeling of the spirit of the occasion, he was brought to tears. He requested forgiveness and even requested a chance to accompany Elder Kimball and his companions to Britain. And the First Presidency was glad to accept that. So we had two apostles, and it's pretty important, really, to have a pair. And then they end up calling three other Englanders who had converted to the church in Toronto, Isaac Russell, John Goodson, and John Snyder. So we have now seven original missionaries.
Wow. That's And so where did they go first? And let's recount their landing, where they go, why they go, where they go, and what leads up to their beginning of the great missionary success there.
It's amazing how fast this went, given the time and the transportation difficulties and also financial problems. It was on the 5th of June that Joseph first had these promptings and called Elder Kimball. And then on the 22nd of June, they were able to leave from New York, and they took a ship called the Garrick. And instead of 5 to 6 weeks passage, this one went really rapidly. It took only 18 days, and they landed in Liverpool. Britain, as I've mentioned, was a very powerful nation. Their Industrial Revolution that had taken place since 1815 had transformed Britain into a nation that produced all kinds of materials that could be exported and make them rich. Of course, the people suffered under this with bad housing, poor sanitation, oppressive working conditions and the like. But the place they chose to go was Preston, and they hadn't made that final choice until they were in Liverpool. They had to spend 3 days waiting for their trunks to go through customs. Joseph Fielding was from Preston. Preston was to the north on the River Ribble. He had a brother who was the minister of a congregation. And it's important to point out that while the Church of England was the official church of the British Empire, by this time, especially brought on by the Industrial Revolution and religious freedom that existed, there were many nonconformist churches. And and James Fielding, the reverend, was a pastor of a nonconformist group. It wasn't even denominationally connected. And Joseph Fielding had written ahead to James Fielding saying he was coming. James had read these letters over the pulpit in the Vauxhall Chapel that he had. And so they decided under the influence of prayer to go there. And they were immediately given the opportunity in the Vauxhall Chapel to speak.
Huh. So you have these connections there. But what were the factors, the beliefs, or other things that are going on in the Preston area that really contribute to magnificent success? So why were they so receptive to the message of these American missionaries?
Since 1689, the British government had given in to the pressures from Parliament and the people to allow for more than one religion. And all a person had to do was to get a license to preach and then behave according to the laws, and he could go forward and build a congregation. And as I said, there were nonconformist religions and many dissenters, and these people had already taken the step, big step, to go away from the Church of England, an Episcopal thing that had a lot of regulations that they didn't like. And the people were ripe for the listening, particularly since they were also quite poor. They were among the factory workers who had been oppressed during the Industrial Revolution. So we had a religious freedom. We had people with a religious stirring. There's a great awakening going on in England religiously, and it was just ready to move forward.
Thank you. You're listening to Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. My guest is Dr. Bruce Van Orden. Bruce, let's continue and talk about some of the great experiences and great significant events associated with those first missionary efforts there in Preston and the regions roundabout. Why don't you tell us some of the great events associated with those missionaries?
Thank you. God certainly watches over all. And in those days of lack of communication opportunities, he was certainly watching over what was happening in America under Joseph Smith and then with Heber C. Kimball and his brethren in Britain. On the very day that the brethren first preached in the Vauxhall Chapel, the Lord opened the way there, but he also revealed to the prophet Joseph Smith the role of the 12 in the future, and that's section 112 of the Doctrine and Covenants, that after much tribulation, in whatsoever place ye, the 12, shall proclaim my name, an effectual door shall be opened unto you, that they may receive my word. That was promised on that very day. However, there were adversarial experiences, mostly from Satan himself. They felt his satanic power. On Saturday, July 29th, the missionaries confronted Satan and his minions. Isaac Russell had come into Elder Kimball Neller Hyde's room to ask for a blessing, and then Elder Kimball wrote in his journal, "I was struck with a great force by some invisible power and fell senseless on the floor as if I had been shot, and the first thing I recollected was that I was supported by Brothers Hyde and Russell, who were beseeching a throne of grace in my behalf. They then laid me on my bed, but my agony was so great that I could not endure, and I was obliged to get out. I fell on my knees, began to pray. I then sat on the bed and could distinctly see the evil spirits who foamed and gnashed their teeth upon us. We gazed upon them about an hour and a half, and I shall never forget the horror and malignity depicted on the countenances of these foul spirits." And interestingly, later that day, after they were healed, they went and did their first baptisms. Joseph Smith rejoiced when he learned of this satanic manifestation. That's very interesting. He said to Elder Kimball in a letter, "It gave me great joy, for then I knew that the work of the Lord had taken root in the land. It was this that caused the devil to make a struggle to kill you." They baptized about 1,500 souls in about 10 different villages that were close to Preston during 9 months in that area before being called back. And they were called back by the prophet Joseph Smith, the apostles were, Elders Kimball and Hyde, so that they could go back and be instrumental in getting organized the entire Quorum of the Twelve to come back and carry on with the mission.
Wow. So that first effort produced such incredible results and then lays the foundation for subsequent missions of the Twelve. So why don't you tell us about the later mission of the 12, the 1840, 41, those kinds of mission experiences. What leads up to that and who's involved in the later mission to Great Britain?
Elder Kimball and Elder Hyde returned in early 1838, only to find that their prophet and the First Presidency and most of the saints in Ohio had left. They were basically driven out and had gone on to Missouri, where things got from bad to worse during that year. And by the end of the year, Joseph Smith and members of the First Presidency were incarcerated, and the members of the church had sought refuge in Illinois. And it just was a terrible situation. Instead of helping to organize a mission, these brethren went on to Missouri, and particularly in the case of Elder Kimball, he joined hands with two other brethren, Brigham Young and John Taylor, who had been called the 12th subsequently, in caring for the needs of the saints. These three brethren were not known by the Missouri folks and therefore kind of an incognito could help organize the exodus and caring for all the needs, spiritual, physical, mental, of the saints. So it had to be postponed, this whole idea of going to all the world. However, in section 118, because of that great apostasy that I referred to, four of the original 12 had fallen, and section 118 was given to replace those who had fallen. And those called were John Taylor, Willard Richards, Wilford Woodruff, and John E. Page. Actually, Brother Woodruff was before Brother Page. And then during the Missouri conflict, a member of the 12 was killed, and he was then replaced by Elder George A. Smith. So we had five replacements. It needed to be actually six before it was all over because Thomas Marsh, the president of the 12, later also apostatized. So the 12 was going through a tremendous transition themselves. But it wasn't until late 1839 that the prophet Joseph, now in Commerce to be Nauvoo, Illinois, and across the river in Iowa, was able to meet with the members of the 12 and prepare them for that mission, which he did with great enthusiasm, and they responded with total humility and dedication themselves. It turned out that only nine of the 12 made it to Britain. They wanted all of them to go. The three who didn't go were William Smith, who stayed behind for at least a while to help with the publication of church newspapers, and also a member of the Illinois State Legislature. We had John E. Page, who started on his mission but didn't finish it. And then we had to replace Thomas Marsh, and Lyman White was called, but he was not called until the end of that mission. So we only had nine who went. And Brigham Young led that group, but he wasn't actually officially sustained as president of the 12 until he got into Britain and they held their first conference over there.
Interesting. And so What kind of things do you see different in that second mission from the first mission, and how did they build upon that as well?
Well, you had to have people to lead the saints in the absence of the apostles, and they were led very well. Joseph Fielding was called as the president of the mission, Will Richards' first counselor, and a prominent convert, William Clayton, as a second counselor. They did a magnificent job of keeping the church together. They had to deal with some apostasy, but they then also went forward and did some missionary work on their own. Prominently in Manchester, which was the big city closest to Preston, where William Clayton himself went and was instrumental in converting about 240 people during that two-year interim. So the first thing that the 12 did was to go to Preston. They're actually arrived in two different segments. The first to arrive were a pair of newly called apostles, John Taylor and Wilford Woodruff. They arrived in Liverpool and went immediately to Preston, and then it was organized that they would go elsewhere, John Taylor back to Liverpool and Wilford Woodruff further south. And both of them had quite a bit of success. In terms of numbers, Wilford Woodruff amazingly prominent. It was January when Brother Taylor and Brother Woodruff arrived and started their labors. It was June when Brigham Young and the other members of the 12 arrived. Orson Hyde, not yet. He would come later. They went and held a conference and invited representatives of the various branches, and this included those that were created in the first mission and those that had already started in Liverpool and in the south of Britain prior to July. And it was an exciting thing that Brigham Young became was the president of the 12, and he began to shine so amazingly as an administrator. He was kind. He was organized. He had enthusiasm. People knew he had authority. He was able to exercise the authority righteously. And he was a mission president that was able to send missionaries to the appropriate place. Now, remember, it wasn't just apostles who were there. Yes, nine apostles, but a few American elders had come. A number of British elders had been called as well. So you had a growing missionary force. The apostles, however, were the ones who would go to the prominent places and begin the labors. We have John Taylor working in Liverpool, where he converted a few Irish people. He also was involved in the conversion of a George Cannon family. Leonora Cannon, John's wife, was sister to this George Cannon, and the entire family joined the church. 12-year-old George Q. Cannon was among them, and he, of course, was a prominent player in the church in later years, and also in Britain. But with these Irish folks, he went to Ireland and had some minimal success in Ireland. That was the more difficult thing because the Catholic Church held sway at that time. He also went to the Isle of Man in between Ireland and Britain and had even better success there and established a branch. Elder Orson Pratt was assigned to go to Scotland, and he took some Scottish natives who had joined the church in Canada with him, and they had success in Glasgow area and in the Edinburgh area. They started a tradition that holds to today. They went to a prominent outcropping near Edinburgh called Arthur's Seat, and he dedicated Scotland for the preaching of the gospel. And all missionaries who are called to Scotland go to Arthur's Seat as the first part of their mission to get acquainted with that tradition. London, of course, needed to be visited, and several apostles went there. Wilford Woodruff was among those, George A. Smith, Heber C. Kimball. London was an entirely different place, though. It was the only city in the world at that time that had over a million inhabitants. It was all commerce. A lot of people had much more interest in material things than they had in religious things. It wasn't quite the religious feeling there, but they did establish some branches, and at least we got established in that capital city. But over that period of merely 12 months, we saw 4,500 baptisms.
Amazing.
And 1,000 Latter-day Saints between June of 1840 and 1 year later had left Britain to go to Nauvoo in immigration. And this began the great emigrating event that ended up in 37,000 Latter-day Saints leaving Britain in subsequent years.
Wow. And so was, there was the call then from Nauvoo to the saints to gather to the, I guess you'd call it a portion of Zion or whatever, or they just wanted to be with the prophet. What were the factors in starting that immigration movement from British Isles?
It always goes back to Revelation. And in the New York revelations that led up to the moving of saints to Ohio, Joseph Smith and the leadership of the church had been called to gather the saints from the four quarters of the earth. And the gathering, as it was known in the 19th century, always meant leaving behind your native land or your native area, your native state, and gathering to where the headquarters of the church was, and that would be Zion, and gather to Zion. And that was the doctrine and practice of the church. That really didn't even change so completely until the 1950s, but it was very prominent and official doctrine of the church throughout the entire 19th century. Leave behind your native land as soon as you can arrange your affairs. And these early British immigrants were excited to be with the prophet, that's for sure. But they had received letters inviting them to come as well. And it turns out that there were about 15,000 members of the church in America at that time, and immediately were reinforced within a year by 1,000 British saints. And then before the saints left for the Mountain West under Brigham Young, 5,000 British saints had gone to America, and hardly with any exception, they remained faithful. Close to half of the American saints who were in and around Nauvoo didn't remain faithful to the 12. And so we had this influx of British blood that was so significant in building up the Intermountain West. And then after 1852, when all the saints had been gathered out of the Midwest and were in the Utah or Deseret Zion, it turned out that over the next few years, the majority of the adults in the church in Utah and surrounding areas were British born, mm-hmm. the majority of them.
Wow. And we continue to have the influence virtually, I would say virtually all of the saints in the Wasatch Front area, probably with the exception of those that have come in maybe in recent years, but most of those that trace our pioneer ancestry back have ancestors that were the fruits of those great British missions, as well as later when the European missions open up. So, Bruce, you've studied this so long and hard. What would you say personally, and as you bring it to an end here, what would you say is the enduring legacy, the overall effect of those first missions? The missions go on, but those first missions of the 12 to Great Britain, how did they shape the church, and what do we learn as Latter-day Saints today that we can take with us?
For one thing, this is not an American church. Mm-hmm. The United States of America is the base of operations, as President Edgecliff Benson said, and it remains that. It's so important to be that. But the gospel is to go to all the world. And all are alike unto God. And know ye not that there are more nations than one, Nephi asked, the people of the world. So everywhere we take the gospel. And it is always under the direction of the First Presidency, then under the 12, then under the 70. And the First Presidency and 12 portion certainly came to pass in this period of time. We see that they fulfilled their mission so marvelously. They went back to Nauvoo after this. Always leaving behind, however, at least one apostle to preside over that mission. There was always that authority that would be there throughout the rest of the 19th century, Parley P. Pratt in this first instance. But when they got back to Nauvoo, the First Presidency and the Prophet Joseph Smith appointed the 12 to be in charge of the whole church, not just missionary work, and theretofore it had only been missionary work in other parts of the vineyard. Now they were over the whole church, including, of course, Nauvoo. And this was so important that the, as it turned out, when we had the prophet Joseph Smith expire, the 12 rightfully assumed their position over all the church because they had the keys, and this was had manifest in the post-British mission from the prophet to the 12. And then in every subsequent missionary outpouring and beginning in any single land, the 12 were involved. And straight out of that British mission, we have John Taylor, who was later called to leave Britain, go to France, and then to the Germanies, and he helped establish the work in those countries, even the printing and translating the Book of Mormon and other scriptures and so forth. We have Lorenzo Snow, who was a missionary to the British Isles under the 12, but was not a member of the 12 quite yet. He was called in 1849, and when he was called, he had all this experience, and out of the British mission, he was sent over to Italy and established work there as well as in Switzerland. We have Erastus Snow, who was also called in 1849, and he left the British mission to go to Scandinavia, Denmark, and Sweden and Norway to establish the work there. So the work went to all the world sort of as a result of this missionary work in Britain, but the 12 were in their rightful element. And they accomplished this from that moment till the present time.
That's well stated. We've really enjoyed today having Dr. Bruce A. Van Orden as our guest as we've talked about the great missionary efforts in the British Isles that then reach out to filling the whole earth in fulfillment of prophecy. Bruce, thank you so much for being our guest today.
You're welcome.
We hope you'll listen again to a future episode of Past Impressions as we study the history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and examine the people, places, events, and issues associated with that great Latter-day movement. I'm Brent Topp, your host, and on behalf of the Mormon Channel of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, we bid you farewell.